Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, Gary.
Hello, Guy.
So it's a North London derby today.
You're not going to be intimidated, are you, by the fact there's the Camden and Islington boys?
Me? No, I'll be just feeling very smug.
Where were you from? Where? What part of London? Where did you grow up?
Waterloo.
Waterloo, of course.
Waterloo. I'm South. South. Well, there's two ways of looking at it, because Waterloo is such a funny place, is that I'm either from South London or I grew up in the shadow of the National.
You did. Yes, I think that's more you, isn't it, really?
Yeah, I was born in a flat between the Old and Young Vics.
So surprisingly, I never really knew much about Suggs. I never kind of bumped into him at all. I mean, in the 80s, I don't remember sort of meeting up with Madness or doing a Top of the Pops with them. But Chrissy Boy, I did know, because he's 3 years above me at the same school. He was rather mean to the young violinist.
It was quite the school yours, wasn't it? It's got quite the alumni.
He was rather mean to the young violinist, Neil Barnes, that was in my class. He was the only kid who played violin and used to bring the violin into school. And obviously that kind of riled Chris Foreman. This kid, how dare he play a violin? And I think he picked on him a bit. It turns out that Neil Barnes ends up becoming also successful in music in a band called Left Field.
Oh, right. Oh, well, there you
so
go.
So there's another.
Not playing the violin, though.
Not playing the violin. Playing synthesizers and stuff.
And decks.
Yeah. So there's going to be some Cockney jives and japes and...
Some oi oi saveloy.
Oi saveloy. Have a la-di-da.
It'll be great. Do you know what? I've played with Suggs only once. And, you know, I've played with every type of band in front of every type of audience. And this was a thing with Andy Mackay. It was a charity thing. To raise money to repair the roof of his local cricket club pavilion down in Somerset. And I've never said, and it was just a field of people, few hundred people. And as soon as we did the Madness songs, I've never seen anything like this, where people just bounce.
Yeah.
It's an extra, and you think that's what Suggs has looked out on his whole life, just this weird thing of bouncing people. Like sort of weebles.
Where you with the Pink Floyd fraternity, it's rather sort of serious people, isn't it? Always.
Yeah, sort of a lot of swaying.
And with binoculars looking at guitar settings and things. Fly dentists.
Exactly.
Not to besmirch the wonderful Pink Floyd fraternity. So I suppose we should get him on.
Welcome to the Rock on Tours.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
But it's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London, they're brilliant.
That caused a big problem in the band, actually. I was having too much fun.
Thank you guys for still being around, still making music, still being into it, and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
Well, I get the feeling that us three should go for a pint. That's what I think.
I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
And get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock on Tours podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Keep on rocking!
Hello, mate.
Hello, Suggs.
All right, mate. Great.
Suggs, thanks for doing this in your living, getting our producer to come round to your living room or kitchen.
What I love is I've known Ben for a long time from Virgin Radio days.
Oh, I wonder, because I don't think this service has ever been offered to anyone else.
But what I loved is we left Virgin a long, long time ago, both of us doing a bit of DJ, but they asked him to come back. As veteran DJ.
Yeah, right.
39 years old, for fuck's sakes.
Is this generation's Alan Freeman?
Ben Fluff Jones.
Here I am, 63 and a half, you know what I mean? And he's a veteran. Anyway, this is the way it is.
Yeah, well done on the album. Yeah. Well done
cheers,
on the album.
Cheers, thank you, mate. Thank you. Yeah.
I mean, it's you know, there's a real concept feel to it. I love the sort of theatre of the absurd opening and the mention of Samuel Beckett. I mean, what brought that all together?
Well, I mean, you know, I didn't want to go on about it. Can you hear me all right? Because I can't hear myself much in these headphones, Ben.
Yeah,
but that's
we got you. You got
me? Okay, fine, that's fine. We didn't want to go on about it, but we all realised we went through a rather sort of tricky few years, didn't we? With lockdown and pandemic and all that. And we'd all written songs that were about that period of our lives, so we couldn't escape it. But I was reading about that period of Samuel Beckett, and there was this whole movement of the theatre of the absurd, which culminated in a French outfit who actually wrote plays in gobbledygook because they were going, no one's actually communicating anymore.
Yeah.
You know, and it sort of started to feel like we weren't communicating anymore, you know, as a society.
Because you kind of hit that, well, there's a hint of that in the press for the album, said like, it's because lots of people went down all sorts of rabbit holes. I get the feeling maybe there are some members of the band who were having other opinions than other ones.
Totally. You know, I mean, we almost felt completely to pieces in terms of what we were all going on about. But it was like a microcosm of society that everyone had a completely different opinion of why and what and what was going on and why we were doing what we were doing. I remember, I think it was Caitlin Moran, the girl from the Times, wrote this article about how the middle ground sort of disappeared, didn't it? It just got scorched and burnt.
And you
just weren't allowed to share any opinions with anybody else or see two sides of an argument.
Yeah.
But fortunately, when we got back in a rehearsal room together, that's what happens, you know, with music. It's an amazing healer of so much, you know, of societies.
But even though you say about the theatre of the absurd being how it felt during the pandemic, and obviously that's when you were writing stuff, there's also, I can listen to some of the lyrics on that album and that opening song and feel that it's also about celebrity and it's about the ridiculousness of what us three, you know, have gone through, you know. The doors are closed and we can't get out, you know.
A dozen roses, no one sends. No, you might be right there. I'm sure there's, you know, psychiatrists more qualified than you that would probably agree. Yeah, maybe, mate. You don't know unconsciously, do you, what you're really going on about? I mean, it wasn't specific. It was, yeah, about being trapped in the theatre and not quite knowing how or when you're going to get out. I mean, it's like a sax player Lee said, when can we retire? God. It's the Eagles. You can check out any time you like, but you can never leave.
Now, what I like about the sound of the record as well is there is this kind of great sense of Victoriana about it, which is in sort of imbued in so much of your work, you know, and that sort of anarchic sort of London streets that are very Sweeney Todd, and it seems to be that's the kind of madness that you've connected to for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we all follow our different threads, don't we? I mean, for us, you know, our biggest influences were Ray Davies and Ian Dury, you know, and I never really knew anything about music hall until Ian Dury came along. And but funny enough, and then that Theatre of the Absurd, the whole sort of faded grandeur of those old theatres or music halls, I've always been attracted to, and I don't know why, really.
We can hear you fine, Suggs. We can.
I don't sound like I'm ranting, like a shouting lunatic then. No.
Good. Well, that's kind of what we're after.
That'll make a change.
I think that was when I bumped into you in Soho, wasn't it?
Yeah. But, because you're talking about Dury and the musical, because he was around with you guys before you were Madness, right? Wasn't it? You kind of got to know him. Wasn't there a story of, was it one of you hanging upside down by his turnips?
Yeah, it was Kilburn and the High Roads. And it was like, who wouldn't want to see a band called Kilburn and the High Roads? And Lee, our saxophone, I was too young. I kept getting blanked at the doors of Roxy Music, Kilburn and the High Roads, because I was too young. I was just that little bit younger than the rest of them. But Lee bunked in through a window backstage and it had one of them prongles, you know, that holds the thingy-bob. And he got his turnips caught and he was hanging upside down. When he and Dury came
what?
in.
What, It was the Tally Ho pub
in just off Kentish Town, which unfortunately, like so many of those pubs, has gone now.
But is this before punk?
Yeah, it is. This is,
yeah, it was pub rock, wasn't it?
It was pub rock. So yeah. 74, 75, yeah. Plummet Airlines, the original Gorillaz. Oh, I can't remember the rest
Kersal
of them.
Kersal Flyers,
Death School, my wife's band.
Brinsley Schwartz.
No, he was earlier.
They might have been a bit earlier. Dr. Feelgood, Ducks Deluxe.
Bearded Lady.
Plummet Airlines.
but go back to what you said about, you know, being into the music hall and those old places. There was a sort of, and I grew up, actually, my dad, that was my dad's era. Do you know what? I'll tell you a side story, right? My family, when my dad and his brother Percy were small, their dad couldn't make any money because he'd been injured in the First World War, and then he had disability. But their grandfather drove a handsome cab. This is in Islington. But to make side money, they bagged up sweets and peanuts and went down, the whole family, my dad and his brother and mum and dad, and sold them outside Collins Music Hall. So, you know, I've always been in show business.
Just on the pavement outside, that's all it
is. But what I was trying to get around to saying was that obviously there's a sense of old London and nostalgia that's in that, and that always seems to be imbued in your work. Even right back to your earliest songs, I mean, Baggy Trousers was a song written by a young man nostalgically or you know, about his youth. Was that looking back, or was that actually just felt like it was the other day when you wrote that? You know what I'm saying? When you wrote about the schoolyard.
Well, there was two things on that particular song. One was, this was the influence that Ian Dury I was getting from. He was writing these lists of aspects of his life and turning them into a narrative. And I can't remember why I was thinking about that school I went to. And then it was that Pink Floyd song, Teacher Leave Them Kids Alone, come on. And I thought, hang on a minute. Kids leave their flipping teachers alone, is what I can remember. So that just started a process. And I just thought it'd be nice to...
It did seem two sides of the same coin, those two songs.
But that's what I'm trying to say, but I thought it'd be nice to make it fairer, you know, that it wasn't all, you know, we were picked on and they were, you know, I don't know, extraordinarily aggressive weirdos, most of my teachers, unfortunately. But at the same time, we didn't make life easy for them, I know that much, yeah.
You know, when I first went to my primary school when I was 11, my mum, parallels were really fashionable, they were sort of happening, right? Parallel trousers. But my mum just bought me a pair of school trousers that were two sizes too big for me because she wanted me to grow into them. And I was so embarrassed. But what I had to do is I had to go around and tell everyone they were parallels and the latest fashion. So when baggy trousers came out, I completely related to it.
Well, that was it. And, you know, and it's ironic that it had a sort of Dickensian undertone. And that's what people thought. But what I really meant was the Oxford bags from Woodhouse, five buttons and all that, and the pockets down by your knees. What? But it's funny.
And your three-star tank top.
That's it, mate. That's it. Three-star jumper up your back. He's a woolly back. Woodhouse. God, I remember there.
Woodhouse, yeah, Oxford Street. Yeah, we used to get our clothes at Woodhouse, the waistcoats and the soul
and
boys.
It was all that. So, okay, look. We're going to nick a few bits and bobs. Let's all split up, right? And my mate went, come on, let's do that. Next thing I see him running with a whole row of coats out of Woodhouse.
Down Oxford Street.
He said, keep it quiet. Do you know what I mean?
they didn't catch you?
No, they didn't. There was one fat security guard just couldn't keep up. He was going like a packet of crackers.
Well, it was hard to run in your toppers or whatever shoes you're wearing. You know? But, you know, Guy, I'm sort of busting in with my own.
No, please,
here.
Please.
Go ahead.
No, no, I wasn't. No, you were going, I didn't have anything. I got nothing. You're North London. I was South London.
This is a little interesting thing. So for me, after punk, I sort of went a bit soul boy. And Woodhouse was definitely a place to dress for me. What was the music that you were listening to? Because your band were only a few years after that.
Yeah, well, funny you say that, Gary, yeah, because I remember that sort of distinct moment. A lot of my pals were soul boys, because that's, you know, that was what was happening, you know. But I'm going to the Roxy, you know, where punk historically supposedly started. There were very few punk records, and we weren't really into punk music, but Don Letts was the DJ.
Oh, yeah.
And there weren't many punk records, so he was playing reggae records throughout the night. And that's what we started to get into, reggae, and then ultimately going back into ska and all that. But I wonder, I remember, do you remember the pub The Champion on the street?
Yes, yeah. I used to go there.
That was the Soul Boy pub. That was the Soul Boy pub.
There in the Tibbet and Arms.
Tibbs. And like, we was all like that. And then sometimes the Soul Boys would come out of The Champion and we knew we were in a bit of trouble, you know, for all the Crombies and bother boots and all that. They was like all scaffolders, weren't they, and boxers. Soul Boys.
Well, Islington had a few naughty gangs,
It certainly did. The Packington Estate, all that.
But in terms of what you're listening to, because I remember I saw your one-man show and you would say how, like, It Must Be Love, Labi Siffre, was something that you were listening to at that time, which seems quite, that's like quite a broad mix considering, you know, you just
Well, I think, you know, I mean, it was very sort of delineated, but really, when you look back, we were all listening to a very eclectic selection of music. Certainly in my band, you know, from Motley Oople to Alex Harvey to Ian Dury to reggae to ska to soul to Al Green to you know, Marvin Gaye, all of this stuff was in the firmament. But then you kind of had a little scene, didn't you? And your little scene kind of dictated what you were allowed to say you liked.
Yes.
So obviously, you know, Straight Trousers was a big thing, you know what I mean? And not tearing your clothes up or safety pins. And then slowly you sort of get into this. I remember, like, I had friends who were into sort of Teddy Boy music, and then they went into rockabilly, and then they went into bluegrass. It was almost like you had your own little thing that no one else could, you know, and do you know what I mean? I don't even really know why. I think you felt more kind of individual by, like we did. So we went from reggae to ska to rocksteady to da-da-da-da-da-da and backwards into that music, and more obscure records that no one else could find. I think that was probably a lot to do with it.
Well, you know, without wanting to sound too pretentious, but why should I stop now?
Exactly.
I feel like, you know, we were probably the first generation, because my dad was conscripted, first generation that didn't have to wear a uniform, legally. But all of us were looking for uniforms and tribes in different ways. You know?
Yes, interesting. It's interesting.
I did the mod thing. My first band was a mod band. Old 79 mod scene. And it was that same thing of you think you're being rebellious and outside and everything, but it's kind of, but it's all been done for you.
That's right.
Listen to this and you can wear this. And it's like, it's all done.
We're all individuals.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh, I'm not.
What did you want to be when you were a kid? I mean, how did you grow up? You just grew up living with your mum, didn't you? Sucks.
I grew up living with my mum. Yeah, she worked in bars and sang. She was a very good singer, but she never really made what she wanted to of herself. Did you want that bit of banana cake or what, Ben? I haven't cooked that for nothing.
Sucks. There's one little side thing here, because there's a thing about your childhood that I really recognise and love. You were saying, because like she used to, when she wasn't singing, she'd work at the French, she'd work at the Colony Room.
Yeah.
Because I had the same thing. When my dad wasn't working, he'd fill in behind the bar at Jerry's. Yeah. So I used to sit with my comic down, you know, sit amongst all the actors and everything. So I very much recognise that childhood. It's brilliant.
Well, no, Jerry's very clearly, First time I ever had a Coca-Cola, first time I ever tasted an avocado. I remember it like it was yesterday. And then going down the back of the seats of the sofa, and you'd find a few 20 pences or whatever they were in those days, threepences.
Wraps.
But not in those days. Maybe now you would. So it's a pretty disparate upbringing, because my mum didn't get home till very late. But I was very well, I wanted to go into art. I was quite good at drawing and painting, but I didn't get the qualifications to be able to get to art school. But I was so fortunate, I bumped into the band when I was sort of 15 or 16, and it took off pretty much as soon as I met them. By the time I was 18, I was on Top of the Pop. So
Because they already had a band, didn't they? They were the North London Invaders, were they?
The North London Invaders.
It's great, isn't it?
All the names were great. All, yeah.
But then it turned out there was another band called the Invaders. I mean, whatever happened to them? Anyway, the snivelling shits, they were on the scene at the time as well.
They retreated, I think.
Sore throat, supporting, I think, on that tour.
But so when you bumped into them, was that because you had similar music tastes? Or where was the place?
Yeah, well, no, there was a few pubs. There was the Duke of Hamilton in Hampstead, and we all gravitated up the hill from the lower slopes, the working class slopes of Camden and Kentish Town.
Covered in soot.
To the glorious, the glorious light of Hampstead. Yeah. And I remember following Leo, a saxophone player, setting fire to the bins all the way up the hill like some medieval tribe. But yeah, they had girls, yeah, and people who had parties and parents who were away for the weekend. So we used to hang about up there. Fridges with food in them. You know what I mean? All that. Oh,
libraries, bookshelves.
Records. I remember seeing this suitcase of records appearing down like on a piece of like sheet coming out the window, and I knew it was at the top of it.
So what was that? How come you bumped into? Were they all part of a?
They were just around and about. And the other thing was graffiti. You know, this is a sort of lesser known bit of artistry. You know, all the band were into graffitiing, so I knew Mike Barson was doing. Mr. B did this huge three-dimensional train coming out of a wall in Hampstead, and then Lee used to hang off bridges upside down doing kicks, and I was doing, and it was almost like a kind of coded vernacular that you go, oh, you're Mr. B, oh, and you're Suggs, and so all of our nicknames became something that made us famous, you know, even in them early stages.
Just before it was taxed. But if this is still 70s, when you say graffiti, was it not like the hip hop graffiti?
It was still pretty rubbish. But we decided that, you know, and then there was a book. I remember George Melly had the foreword of this book, and it was something like the Subways of New York. And suddenly we realised that there was a whole other world to this, you know, art form. But Lee, Mike and Chris and them used to then walk across the overground, the North London line.
The Magic Line.
And then in the morning you'd see all these amazing, you know, things coming out of the walls, you know. And it was funny because I don't know how much, I think there's a bit of it recorded, but it wasn't like that, what you just see now is that sort of bubble stuff.
Yeah.
But the other famous memory I had, oh God, I'm on and on. But I was in Highbury Magistrates Court, and I can't remember why. It was something to do with a fray or a policeman. I booted up the arse or something stupid. But I was in the juvenile court, and my mum was having a fag out the window, and she's looked out, and there's Suggs in 8-foot letters on Highbury and Islington railway station.
Wow.
She's gone, isn't that stupid name they call you? I said, I don't know what you're on about, Ryan. Who's done that?
My God. So you saw yourself, in a way, as sort of larger-than-life cartoon characters. There was a sense...
There is something of that going. It's interesting, you know. Who knows exactly how and where, you know. Some of us went to school together, but we gravitated just bit by bit from a sort of gang of probably about 30 different people from that area that were in similar situations. But I think music was the first thing. And I think graffiti then really sort of cemented the artistic kind of endeavour, because I mean, you know, there were so many people that were gonna start bands, weren't they, gonna do this and gonna do the other, but Mike, Lee and Chris and the whole thing started to coagulate sort of seriously because I think of art, fashion, music all at the same time, it suddenly started to make sense.
Would you say that the element I'd add to that is that I guess once you're up and running, the one thing that seems to be really common to you all that really binds you was the humour.
So stupid as fuck.
Yeah. No, the humour, because you
think
you
take it, Gary. That from
yeah. Well, Chrissy Boy went to my school.
I had a look
at his report.
Two Bryce Bolts come out, two intellectuals come out of there, didn't they?
Oh, no, yeah. No, go on, Guy, go on.
No, it's the last amount, is the humour, because that's the one brilliant thing that you project together, you know, especially when all the video started.
Well, I don't know, you know, whatever gets you going, you know, things get you going, don't they? But, you know, it wasn't just that as well. You know, the music hall thing, what we touched on, but that then led into, like, Samuel Beckett, Tommy Cooper, who then we turned out, you know, when you see Crap's last tape, we didn't realise he was actually a huge fan of Tommy Cooper. Tommy Cooper, you know, and then Tommy Cooper, Les Dawson, whatever. I mean, certainly self-deprecation. You know, we took the work very seriously, but we just didn't take ourselves very seriously. Yeah. And it's what we tried to project. You know?
What Guy's saying, I get, you know, there's a history of bands, like even the Beatles, who were always connected with comedy. You know, for them it was the Goons. For us, it would have been Python. And but there's also funny elements in your band of like the Sand Dancers from Music Hall. Those two guys, I forgot what they're called, you know.
What were they called?
It's that thing Betty, that Nick Mason always does.
Betty something and something, wasn't it? Yeah, there was three of them. And I've seen them outside Leicester Square Odeon. Or
Max Wall.
Oh, Max Wall, I mean, of course. Well, funny enough, one of them, do you remember Play for Today? And he wouldn't imagine that's the sort of thing we would watch. But, you know, when it wasn't much on.
Well, everyone watched it. There was nothing else. I mean,
so there was Crap's last tape, Samuel Beckett, and it was Max Wall was playing Crap. And he goes, spool. He says, spool. And the word banana about 15 times in a row. And it's just hilarious.
Just as a side, do you not fancy doing that, Suggs?
What's that?
Crap's last tape.
I do, actually. I'd love to do it.
Well, that's a great idea.
It's a one-hander. Why not?
Funny that, you know, just, I don't know. You know, some things are so sort of intangible. You know, the correlation between Tommy Cooper and Samuel Beckett is perfect in my mind, even though you couldn't possibly join those two concepts together.
No.
You know what I mean? Surreality, we might say.
I could see Max Wall's walk and the madness, the Nutty Boy walk. Because where did that come from? That first album cover up, whatever it, you know.
I don't know. But obviously, from all that, in fact, I've seen a photograph of seven musical artists all doing exactly what we did on the front cover of that first album, and I hadn't seen that before. The other one I remember is this sort of what do you call it, zeitgeist or whatever, is I'd never seen, there's a film of the Kinks doing Dead End Street.
Up in Kentish Town, down that little side street, with the coffin.
Where fucking Lee Thompson lived, our saxophone player, right?
Wow.
And that was after. He's dressed up as a woman in the front door. They've got the coffin. Yeah. That was after we'd done the video for It Must Be Love, where we dressed up as the woman and had the coffin and all that.
Of course.
Now, you just can't, you know what I mean? It all gets too much, doesn't it, to try and extrapolate why these things happen. They just are in the firmament, one way or another.
I can see you being bonded, you guys, on a sense of street humour, right? I can see that, like, your gang kind of glued together with laughter.
For sure. Yeah, and unfortunately, sometimes at other people's expense. But, you know, it's just the way it goes, isn't it?
But that thing, like you said, which starts with that, you know, that amazing... Because actually, I've got to say, that first out, that brilliant image of the seven of you.
Yeah.
I think the funniest meme I've ever seen was that one when Theresa May became Prime Minister and she went to meet the Queen and there's that picture of her doing that unbelievably awkward curtsy. And someone...
I'm thinking of the ABBA dance,
Oh. That's true. No, but it was her doing this curtsy and someone had just stuck the seven of you in front of her instead of the Queen. And it's just the funniest image.
No, there are a few of them now, I've got to say. I've got a few, yeah. People send them to me. Yeah, it's Gorbachev. I can't remember where there's a few of them down the line. Yeah.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Didn't it strike you early on, though, that splitting the fees 7 ways was quite a lot? I mean, that's a lot of people in a band, isn't it, Sucks?
It's funny you should say that, Gal.
Five as far as you were going to prepare to go, Gal.
5, yeah, I drew the line. I wasn't going to have anyone dancing getting paid.
No. Funny enough, I was doing something with Paul Weller recently, and my son-in-law's a huge fan. He went, "It's all right with you, Paul, isn't it? You sacked your band off."
Well, there's only 2 of them.
And it is what I'm going to say. Imagine, I've got another 6 of them wrapped around me. Look, it's just the way we worked it out. I mean, what we did with the songwriting was after the songwriter, after the people who played on the record. And that's the way it's always been, for better or for worse. You know, that's just the way it's been.
Well, that's good, because you've got a few writers, haven't you?
Well, we have everybody, yeah.
Because Lee wrote the first song, didn't he? The first hit.
He wrote the Prince. It's like, how does it take you 7 years to do a new record, considering all 6 of you write songs? If you just wrote, like, 2 each, you could have an album in a year, surely.
Yeah.
But it ain't been like that, you know.
Well, because yeah. Mike got the mantle, didn't he? He was always presented as sort of the writer. It's funny that there's literally one letter difference between his name and Bowie's Piano Genius.
Yes, I know that. There's only one letter different between me and the Slits. Oh, no, maybe 2. Oh, hang on, no, 3.
When did...
I was trying to think of something.
Yeah.
I was trying to think... Pudsey.
Segs
from the Ruts.
There you go.
Segs from the Ruts. Jesus, if only I'd... Well, you know, I was a pound behind him.
Yeah, he gets mentioned every week on this show. When did you realise that actually you weren't on your own in this kind of love of ska and this... There was a sort of a sensibility, a zeitgeist that was going right across the country. Well, but obviously in Coventry.
Yeah, well, it was exactly that. It was funny enough, in Islington, the Open Anchor, where we used to hang out and you know, at a sort of, whatever, pub rock, new wave thing. Stiff was upstairs. And then one day, the Specials walked in, you know, so 7 guys from Coventry wearing pork pie hats and tonic suits, looking like us, sounding like us, slightly better than us. And we thought, hang on a minute, there's something going on here.
Yeah, did you think you'd have to kill them?
That's right. Didn't know whether to feel jealous or vindicated. Yeah. Bit sort of both.
It's like Jerry. Yourself.
I was talking to Jerry afterwards, and he's never had any teeth. And like, and if he wanted to have somewhere decent to stay after a gig, he best bet was pulling a bird. And with them teeth, he ended up sleeping at my mum's flat. But I swear, you know, and sometimes you think, but it wasn't. He said to me at 3 in the morning, "I'm going to start a record label. I'm going to start an English Motown." I said, "Don't you think that's a smidge optimistic, Jerry, seeing you just played to 35 people in a pub basement?
And you've got no teeth.
But 6 months later, he rang me up and said, "Look, I've done it." And it was just that is the zeitgeist. We'd just done our first demos. You know what that's like, Gary, where you just think, Jesus Christ, we're hanging on by our teeth here. We can barely play these fucking instruments. Yeah. And we'd done The Prince and Madness, and it just sort of sounded all right, you know. And he went, "Yeah, I could just do with something to put out on 2-tone. And that was it. He put The Prince out, and it was a hit. It went into the top 20.
And who else was there? The Specials? Who else was there? Selector,
The Beat, and then...
I never really saw The Beat as doing the same sort of music, but I get it.
Now, mostly it was The Specials and The Selector,
Rankin Roger.
Rankin Roger, God rest his soul. I mean, so many of them gone, which is the saddest thing. Of this time of our lives.
But so then you went out on a tour, didn't you, with them?
Yeah, so that was the highlight of my life, the two-tone tour. So we all met up at the Roundhouse. I was 16, 17. So there's a special selector. Then Dexys Midnight Runners came on the bus. Can you imagine? Fucking what a scene. So anyway.
I thought their whole thing was bunking trains. Do you know what I mean? That was their whole thing, wasn't it? We're going on tour with bunking trains. So what are they doing on a bus?
Well, you can do both. They're not mutually exclusive. We used to bunk trains.
Carrying their bowling ball bags, isn't it?
That's
bowling
right. With nothing in them. It's nothing. Bobble hats. Bags.
How did you and Kevin get on? I mean, listen, you, Kevin, Chaz and Jerry. I mean, that's some serious
blokes. Well, we all went a bit haywire, you know, and I think any one of those human beings will tell you it wasn't always completely in control.
Well, also, there's just so many people in your bands. I mean, how many people were on that bus?
Well, there you go. Hundreds. There were hundreds. But I remember it was delineated by the fact that the people who drank were at the front, the people that took amphetamines were in the middle, and the people who puffed were at the back. So you can guess where we were. Running up and down that aisle. Chickens in a hen run.
Oh, my God.
But just, you know, and it was all that, you know, Rico and all these proper old, you know, professionals. And then there's us. And we were like the sort of clowns of the operation. Not, you know, just we were the youngest. You know, we were the youngest. And to us, it was just a non-stop party, you know. And that's what it's like when you're that age, isn't it?
Yeah. But the thing that kind of drove you away from two-tone was just the regional aspect, wasn't it? You were just...
Well, there's a bit of that, but also that, you know, two-tone very specifically was to promote the music of Jamaica ska music, right, which we loved and still do, but we just felt the other things we wanted to do wouldn't fit in, you know, like all the musical thing and all variety or kinks and the enduring... And then just Stiff just turned up out of the blue, and it was just the perfect place for us because it was equally creative and free and, what's the word they used to say? You know, it's not a conglomerate, it's a...
Collective,
isn't it? No, free record label. There's a word for it. Anyway, it wasn't...
Yeah, because the sense of being with Jerry, you know, Jerry, I would have thought, would have wanted his band to succeed the most, right? He was always going to be on top. But with Dave Robinson, right?
That's right, Stiff, that's right.
You know, you had a proper A&R man who just wanted your success.
Yeah, I think. Again, you know, it's so far away that I can't remember exactly the details, but I just remember we didn't feel like we wanted to stay on two-tone. We went and had a look at all the other record companies and they were horrible, all the big ones, you know. And then independent, that's the word. We bumped into Dave. And at that point, Dave had Elvis Costello, Ian Dury, our hero, Kirsty MacColl, The Pogues, The Damned. It was just like, wow, this is a place to be, you know, for Mavericks.
Nick Lowe was there, wasn't he, as well?
Nick Lowe was there as well, yeah. So it was just full of... It was ironic because most of those artists hadn't been able to get a deal with the major record labels, even though it was picking up the Waves and Strays. And in fact, it was the most perfect place to be. And he was such a dynamic guy. You know, all of those videos that we made were all his dynamism, really, that he could see that there was something in the band that was visual, comically or dramatically or whatever you call it. But he definitely drove the bus, yeah. And we were very happy to be on that bus, yeah.
Did you go on any of those Stiff tours?
We just missed it.
He
did one on a train, which is the one we missed. And then he was trying to buy a DC-10 or something. And we're just going, do you really think you should buy an aeroplane? A record company should buy an aeroplane. I think I'd seen, like, who was it, you know, Lynyrd Skynyrd or something, bought own aeroplane and come
Totally
unstuck.
Because Reckless Eric, I remember, there was some documentary was really unhappy about all that stuff, wasn't it? Like, there was a thing about putting everyone's record out on the same day.
Yeah.
And everything. He did not like that. He thought it would all become about the label rather than the people on it.
I love my label. Malibu loves me. Ask Nick Lowe about that. Yeah, he's always... Yeah, go on.
Now, did was it them that put you together with Langer Winstanley? Because that was a massive relationship with Clive and
them. Alan. Now, what did they do, them? Come on, here's your question.
Gloria.
10.
What? Gloria.
There you go. Them. Van Morrison. Yes, he put us together. Van. He came and he said, here, guys. I said, where are you? It was down there somewhere like that. I said, Van. Stand up. He said, I am. No, you can't.
You were Deaf School fans, weren't you? Already, or you were? Didn't you know them before?
Well, yeah, Deaf School again. Yeah. It was a bit like the Kilburn and the High Roads thing. Yeah. They started playing in pubs in Camden Town and just some peculiar reason. Then they played at the Roundhouse. We all went to see them. They were a huge influence on us. But that, again, was just pre-punk. It was like 75.
That's right, 75,
70. Punk blew them out of the water because they were a seven-piece band, theatrical, you know, and then all of a sudden you had to be three or four people. But then, you know, just couldn't hang on. If they just lasted till 78, they would have been all right when we started because, the whole thing had changed its dimension.
Yeah, because you're right, because there was a sense of, you know, it went from the theatrical and art school to anger, expressing anger.
Yeah, exactly.
That's something you never did, you guys, did you? It was never about anger.
No. And you know, fast things went. It'd be one summer, wouldn't it? Probably only 76, 77, very brief period. Yeah. And then it was sort of like, it's all right, you can sort of calm down a bit now. And not calm down energetically, but calm down, also... You know, the whole two-tone thing, which is the same energy as punk, but it was just a more positive outlook as to what you were trying to say and what you're trying to express. I mean, not positive, but not angry.
Well, multicultural, for sure.
Well, that's for sure.
But going back to Lang and Winstanley, because I just
how
your relationship developed through them, because they came out of Deaf School, right? And then...
Yeah, so Clive was the lead guitarist, songwriter in Deaf School, with my wife's band... My wife was in that band, Deaf School, who I met. And we saw them a few times, and they were great, and just never quite made it. And then Alan Winstanley had done some work. I think he'd done The Stranglers.
That's right, yeah.
But then he did Knock on Wood by Amy Dubry.
Grant.
Yeah, and it was just like, hang on a minute, he must be quite interesting if he does The Stranglers and Knock on Wood by Amy whatever. Disco business. And it just worked out that perfect combination that Clive was a sort of ideas, you know, construction, arrangements, key changes, and Alan was just a really good engineer, and the pair of them just really hit it off. I mean, and they went on to have make so many great records, not just ours, although ours were the best, obviously, but, you know, they made some other good ones.
I did more of that work. We worked with them together on a film with Gary.
Very crazy. Nice people. Very nice.
Look, fantastic. I love
Clive. What was the film?
Still Crazy.
Oh, yeah.
Bill Nye.
But in fact, I played with you with Clive Suggs. We did one of the most brilliant, hilarious gigs. Do you remember we did that charity fundraiser for lovely Andy Mackay's? It was to raise the money.
Roxy Madness or Madness Roxy.
Roxy Madness. It was fantastic.
It was terrible.
It was Andy Mackay calls up, says, I've got this charity thing. And you think, oh, some great thing. And it was to raise the money to get a new roof for the pavilion of his local cricket
pavilion.
Club.
That's right. Yes. I don't think we managed it, mate. I think we still owe them.
What I will say about playing those songs with you, it is, I've played to every sort of audience in the world, but playing those Madness songs, see the way people, they bob up and down. I mean, no wonder you had a fucking earthquake. Madness. It must be an amazing thing that you look out to every night. It is literally, Gary, it's a sea of people just bobbing. It's amazing.
Well, I don't do it as often as I used to, which sort of makes it a bit more fun. But when I do, I genuinely believe I enjoy it more. Yeah. Funny enough, I was Chris Sullivan, you know him, yeah, Gary, don't you? Yeah, and he came down and he doesn't give a fuck about Madness, of course he don't. But he said, it was just like unbridled joy. Now, that's not a bad phrase, is it, to have thrown about? And people just really dig it, you know. You can't quantify it, you can't take it away. you know, if you want to do it, do it. If you don't want to do it, then, you know, someone else will. But
and that was the thing about what you were doing, because it was so joyous that and comic, but in a very sensitive, melancholic way, that you it was hard to ever be against madness, no matter what other tribe you were in. You know, you couldn't not like madness. No,
thank you very much. Yes.
You know, I'm sorry, take that as a backhanded compliment.
No, of course I do, mate. No, because of course we all hated each other. Yeah, of course we were all in competition. But I don't know what it was that made us have this sort of weird moral compass that... I don't know. I really honestly don't know. I can't explain it. Right, you've had enough now. You've had enough. Look, come on.
No. The other thing is how many fantastic singles you had. When you started, did you see yourself as... That was your aim, to be a singles band? Because there was a lot of artists out there just wanted to make great albums, weren't there? But, you know, we get to Absolutely, and it's like just tons of the things.
No, we didn't. And it was funny that, again, it was a funny anomaly of Dave Robinson's that he said, why don't you? Because, no, of course we wanted to have hit albums, but we weren't. The albums were doing all right, but the singles were doing much better. Singles were selling millions, you know. He said, we'll do a compilation of your singles. We went, but at that point, only people who were dead do compilations. Yeah. The singles. I said, give us a chance, Dave. But anyway, you know, he said, look, we put out Complete Madness compilation album for Christmas, and it was our biggest selling album. So it was obvious that was where it was headed. You know, the singles were...
But did you find them easy to write, or was there...
It was very hard, mate. I mean, you know who knows about that creative process. I mean, I remember, funny enough, Absolutely, we had no singles at all. I remember a blackboard and I could see, like, there's nothing on there that looks like a hit, right? We had all the titles of the songs written down. And then that's when I wrote Baggy Trousers, and then Mike walked in with Embarrassment. And it was like, just at the end of the session, who would have known it, do you know what I mean, that those two songs pop up? You just don't know. You really don't know. I mean,
yeah.
I do think that we always had an aspiration not to worry about whether we had a hit single. You know what I mean? Trying to write a hit single is a job, isn't it? It's not a job, what we do. It's fun. You know, what's fun is just seeing what happens, you know. I mean, embarrassment. No chorus. Not the title's not even in the fucking song. What is that about? It's just a great big saxophone solo with chords going all over the gaff. It's not a chorus.
But there was a spirit, great spirit in it.
Mm.
But do you think, saying that, seeing as you were such a singles band, I mean, you made some great comment a while back about you split up in 86 to give some other people a chance to catch up, to have more, as many hit singles in the 80s, and no one did.
We were in the charts more than anybody else. We gave them 4 years to catch up. Anyway.
But then...
Tough shit.
In your act two, if you will, the sort of madness, you now do these very ambitious sort of sprawling concept albums.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, The Liberty of Knowlton Folgate. I mean, brilliant. And then the new one, that, you know, it's like you've become a sort of prog version of yourself.
Exactly. Progressive pop. That's it, mate. Yeah. Progressive pop. We didn't intend to. But I think, you know, other thing has been that we've always tried to expand our horizons, you know, not in a huge way, you know, but if you think, you know, we did calypso songs, we did a bit of jazz, we did a bit of rock, we tried to sort of keep it moving. And then it was almost inevitable that we'd start writing songs that were a little bit longer and a little bit more fucking boring. No, a little bit progressive. And certainly Knowlton Folgate really changed the whole horizon for us, because we were getting sucked into a sort of 80s nostalgia thing, and we had to get out of that, if we wanted to live.
Where did that idea come from? Because it's brilliant. Also, I didn't really, you know, this like this sort of free state in the middle of London, isn't it? Like,
yeah, I just picked up a book. I can't remember. It was by an old vicar who was working in Shoreditch, and I forget the name of it now, but he just talked about the Liberty of Knowlton Folgate, and I didn't realise there were a number of liberties that were outside the walls of London, where you could do what you wanted, and struck me as something very interesting. Well, I mean, I wouldn't mind a couple of people I could think of off the top of my head, but I wouldn't personally. But they just survived. In a very odd way. And there's not very little record. There's very little record because they were like, literally like sort of hillbillies, you know, living outside the walls of society. So it's
like that place in is there a place in Denmark? There's a
oh no, Christiansen, but yeah, Christiansen.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's, although this is very, it's very Peter Ackroyd sort of thing, isn't it?
It is for sure, yeah, because he is a London historian,
as opposed
to a Danish historian, yes.
But Guy just jumped into your second act, but I just wanted to, you know, in 86 there was a split. Did you feel that you didn't have, you'd kind of run all your creative juices out in Madness, or you just couldn't stand each other anymore? And
yeah, well, you know that, yeah. I mean, it was health reasons.
Yeah, yeah.
We were fucking sick of each other. No,
because it's all you do, isn't it? You make an album, you're doing it on a tour, you make an album.
Well, you know that, Gary, and for sure, when I look back, we were existing in a sort of 60s paradigm, you know. It's like we were touring, three singles, tour, album, three singles, tour, album, home for about 2 weeks a year for five years, man. And it just got exhausting. And then our keyboard player, Mike, just had enough and fell in love with a girl and he moved to Holland. And it was the best thing that could have happened because we kind of stumbled on for a bit, but then we just thought, without him, it's a bit like losing your arm or something. We stopped, and that was great. We just all went back to normal life, 4 or 5 years, whatever normal life is these days. But
well, you say back to normal life, but I mean, it's, but you were so young when you started, you hadn't really had
a normal life. Well, no, I mean, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Whatever you see as normal life. Yeah. But just me not being in a pop band, you know, not being a pop star. And, you know, I remember that when people start moaning about being a pop star, Pavarotti or someone said, you pack it up for 6 months, don't worry, it'll soon go away. You see people moaning about it.
In this part of your movie, someone now is painting over the Suggs graffiti, right? You know, council whitewashing it. And you're walking past a blank wall.
And I thought, I can't do it again. No, those days are gone.
What I couldn't believe is that Mike, who took over from Mike, was Paul Carrick from
Yes.
Us.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe, I never knew that. It's incredible. I mean, he completely seems like a very sort of serious musician.
No, there was nothing better than going off stage for a fag and letting him do our long on his own. Like, go on, right. Paul, mate.
Right.
Amazing.
Yeah. So Guy was talking about Madstock earlier and this so-called story of the earthquake.
Yeah.
Go on, fill us in.
Well, there was, and you can see it online. There's a Scottish, you know, seismologist, whatever you call him, comes down and it's recorded as 4.5 on the Richter scale. We played there on a Saturday night and then it sold out and we played there on a Sunday night. And then there was another earthquake and the police had to accept that it was due to the Madness concert. But they evacuated all these flats at the back of the park.
Because of your crowd jumping up and down, I could just...
I was going to say, you know...
God.
I know they put on a bit, but I didn't realise it was quite that much. You know what I mean? No, it is, I swear to God. You've got to look it up.
Into their Harringtons, yeah.
That is amazing.
I'm not saying fat, extremely fat, bald blokes all jumping up and down at the same time.
But it must have been joyous to know that you'd been away for all those years, but there was a whole generation that just wanted
to. For sure. Yeah, we haven't played together for 6 or 7 years. And the point of doing that, it was Vince Power used to do this Irish festival, the Flaw.
He's the borderline, wasn't he, Vince Power? Have I got that right?
Yeah, that's right. Started off with second-hand furniture, then country and western, and then Irish thing. And the Flaw, we used to go to. Carl and a few of the band were Irish, so we used to go down there. And he just said, why don't you guys just... I said, look, I could leave the stage up till next weekend. Won't cost you nothing. Why don't you just do... Because we hadn't done a final gig, that was the point. We'd sort of fizzled. We hadn't told anyone that we'd split up. So he said, right, we'll do a final gig, yeah. And that was it. And it just went off, yeah. And it was amazing to see how much enthusiasm there still was for this.
Who supported you on that
outfit? We had everyone, didn't we? We had flipping everyone. Everyone I asked, you know, the Pretenders, Ian Dury and the Blockheads, Flowered Up. Oh, I can't remember who else played. Then we made the mistake of asking Morrissey if he wanted to play on the Sunday. And he fucked it right up. Anyway, lo and behold.
What happened? I can't remember.
He put up a big picture of like skinheads and Union Jack flags and all that. And everyone went, what are you fucking talking about? And started throwing things at him.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah.
He tried to stir it up, you know. He tried to stir it up. The point of the matter was, yes, at that. And then we put out another greatest hits, Divine Madness. Just in case you forgot about the first one. It's got new artwork. It's got new artwork and everything.
Yeah. But the musical, Our House, it's got to be one of the... Was that one of like the first jukebox musicals around one band?
Well, I think ABBA and then Queen.
They'd already happened. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you know, who made small fortunes. Guess what we didn't?
but it went well.
Making a movie out of it, actually. They've been talking about it for years. Does look like they're making a movie. It did well. It was just that we spent too much on the production. You know what I mean? Annual outgoings, 1 shilling and sixpence. Annual income, 1 shilling.
But to be fair, Suggs, it's because of your audience. I mean, West End musicals live on coachloads of American tourists,
people from
the Midwest and everything. And that's that. You know, that wasn't who you sold records to.
No, exactly, totally, 100%.
Yeah.
You know, we weren't really very big in America, and Queen were. So, you know, I've got no disregard for the fact that even though their one was shit. That they're much more popular than us, you know.
It was called Our House, and I've always had such a love for that record. I was still living at home when that record was out, and I was writing stuff for the next Spandau album, probably.
Yeah.
I remember it on Christmas Top of the Pops. And just, it was very moving. I always found that record really moving. You know, I'm sitting there with my mum and dad, you know, in Our House, although it wasn't very big, but it felt like it connected spiritually.
Where was it? You was in the Angel, weren't you?
No, Essex Road, just off Essex Road.
Oh, right, yeah.
In Islington, Elmore Street at that point.
You know, I mean, none of us thought that record would resonate as much as it has. You know, and even Carl, who wrote the words, I think would say, you know, it was a slight exaggeration onto the sort of, you know, perfect nature of living in a house with your family. But, yeah, it's funny how it goes, man. It's funny how it goes. I mean... That was a great Clive Langer and Alan Winstanley production. You know, the whole arrangement and then their
productions on all those singles was amazing. Yeah. They were actually so they were like Trevor Horn records, really. In their way. I mean, all these amazing.
Still sounds very powerful, doesn't it? Yeah. Still sounds like got a bit of body in it. Yeah.
Well, yeah, but also the lyrics of House of Fun. I mean, wow, what a song to write about that. You know, burgeoning sexuality and trying to buy a condom. I remember it coming on the TV and I actually blushed in front of my mum.
What's this all about then, son?
Also, remember, you know, there's that town, Gary, we played there last year. It's that town called Aarhus. Aarhus.
Aarhus, yeah, and we couldn't stop singing it.
And you couldn't stop, and whenever anyone says Aarhus, you can't stop but say in the middle of our street. I mean, yeah.
Aarhus.
Tell me about it, you slags. We played there. Guess what we couldn't stop singing? Yeah. So can't keep doing that. Gotta stop singing. Our House. I mean, it is, isn't it? It's the Scottish version of Our House.
Absolutely. I've got to ask you about this, Suggs. Rock on Seine, at Seine. Did you witness the Gallagher brothers having a punch up?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, well, we were there the day they split up. Yeah.
What happened?
Well, there was two bits to the story, and I'm pretty sure they're both true. We were supporting them, and then suddenly it was announced that we weren't on the same stage as them. They wanted us to be on a smaller stage. And I mean, yeah, the theory might be they were worried about, you know, whether we were going to blow them off or not, which is very unlikely. Anyway, we come off stage, and it's like, gigs been rammed, there were people hanging out the trees on the roofs of the ice cream vans, everything. Then I hear this clang from the dressing room next door, and it turns out, that Liam or Noel, one or the other, was it the other one over the head with his guitar?
I think it was Liam hit Noel, wasn't it?
Yeah. God, let's get it right. And my kids had come running back and went, Dad, I think they've had a bit of a row in the dressing room. Anyway, I don't know what happened after that. They obviously stormed off in different directions. Then the promoter came up. And I did feel sorry for him because he'd had Amy, I mean, God bless her, he'd had Amy Winehouse on the year before and she'd blown him up. So he wasn't having a lot of luck with his main act. He said, look, is there any chance you can go on? Because Oasis have gone. I said, what do you mean they've gone? He said, they've split up.
Oh, my God. Oh,
God. I said, well, how much were they going to get then to do the main show? And he went, oh, no, you can't be like that. You can't be like that. I said, what do you mean can't be like that? So I pretended there was a taxi behind the tent and I'd gone, right, I'm off. See, as if I was in the middle of a field like that. And he's running after me. He went, yes, all right. I won't go into the vulgar details, but it was quite a lot of money. Then our road crew are going, look, don't, Suggs. They're going to murder you if you go on there. They're throwing bottles, everything they get their hands on at the stage. But at that point, they were just pleased to see anything. I mean, Bucks Fizz could have come on and they'd have been happy. But it was a sad day. Yeah, I seen them getting off the train when we got back to King's Cross, and that was the end of that. Yeah, that was the end of that.
You wrote about it in your book, didn't you? I remember this, about you getting on a Eurostar and they were getting on. It said the difference between the two families. You prefer yours.
Our carriage was like just kicking up. We were falling out of the compartment all over the gap. And they were like not talking to each other. But, you know, this is how it goes sometimes in families. We all know that.
Yeah. Talking about our house, what about playing that on top of Buckingham Palace? I mean, that was a great moment, wasn't it?
Of course it was. Yeah.
What was it? How did it work? How did you get up there? What was it?
Well, oh God,
Brian May's
a long
still there.
Story. Yeah, I know.
Yeah, oh, you don't mind telling a long story, do you, Sucks? You're going to be doing it for the rest of your life.
Well, as my wife says, yeah, you really hate talking about yourself, don't you? Yeah, go on.
It's called work.
So we got a letter from the Queen, and you're going like that, and you, oh, come on. And the missus, and everyone's going mad. It's a letter from the Queen. What are we going to wear? We're going to do it.
Dear Suggs. So what was it?
Yeah, dear Sir Madness. Of Walthamstow. Yeah, would you like to attend the Queen? Says, of course, yeah, lovely. So we get down there for a rehearsal. Went, oh, dear, it's a bit of a problem. Said, Sir Elton John and Sir Paul McCartney want to have their own piano, so there ain't no time for you to get on between. So some geezer at the back goes, well, see what? Why don't we stick them on the roof? And says, yeah. And that's as simple as it was, yeah. And they built us a stage on the roof. I don't know if it was to try and get us out of the way, but it couldn't have been more, you know, iconic or whatever you call it.
That's so funny. Yeah. So if Paul and Elton had been prepared to share a piano...
Exactly. Then we wouldn't have stolen all the limelight. They would have got a look in.
Is it one of the greatest moments?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I mean, I love the Queen. I'm not a mad royalist, okay? And I'm not sure where that whole process is going, but I did love the Queen. It just worked out. You know, we performed good. It looked good. You know what I mean? And it's like, there we are on the roof of Buckingham Palace. Yeah.
I think I'd say it's not to do with being a royalist, but I'd say for the three of us, everyone we know, she was the one constant in our entire lives.
No doubt,
the day
you
were born, you know.
Was it 12 prime ministers came and went, didn't they? Yeah. But no, as I say, looked good. And then they did this projection, which I'd never seen anything like. Now that it was all the go, where it turned the whole Buckingham Palace into a block of flats. You know, it just was incredible, the whole look of it. Yeah.
Did it feel harder when Chas left? Did you feel like that was, because that was such a big part of your...
Yeah, to a certain extent, mate. Yeah, I mean, he went for his own reasons. I mean, he's living in Ibiza, he's doing very well. Funnily enough, mostly off the song Our House, because it's the biggest selling song we've ever had. So
right.
I'm pleased in that context. I mean, he's happy, you know, and it just goes on, whatever it is, you know, and you can only kind of summarise bits of it. You can't kind of put a kind of whole picture. You know, the band goes on and we go on and people like it, and that's the way it is at the moment, yeah.
You said in the, or it says somewhere that in what we were shown to read was that this is the first album you've all agreed on.
The exhaustive notes we were getting.
Notes. This is the first album you've agreed on. I can't believe that's true, but... Is that true?
don't know about that.
I mean, anyway.
I didn't agree to that.
They're the first notes I've agreed on. But no, we did it ourselves, you know. We didn't have Clive and Alan and all the producers that we've had over the years. And it was quite good fun just doing it ourselves, yeah. And I know sometimes that can end up being a bit self-indulgent, but we just rented this industrial warehouse in Cricklewood. And because there wasn't any time constraint on it, we just went on and on and on and on. Did about 40 songs, then argued and argued and argued, and then got them down to about 14. And the album started to sort of form its own. Got Martin Freeman to do a few bits and bobs.
Did you have the idea of the links? Or did that come early?
Mike Barson had that idea, our keyboard player. Yeah, because we were talking about doing it as a double album, having act one, two, three, and four. I mean, a double album, come on. But anyway, then the idea of sort of interspersing bits of conversation into the...
Well, you'd done that on Guess Up, hadn't you? You'd sort of...
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, just trying to make it interesting, aren't you? That's all you're trying to do.
Helen Mirren, getting Helen Mirren. That was... How did that happen?
Wasn't bad. Yeah, exactly.
She reads the lyrics on a video, right, of C'est La Vie. Yeah.
Have you not seen it? No.
I have. I've seen it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Then I can't... It's because can't get her away from me. I said, Helen, please, pack it up, darling. Leave me alone.
Where did you meet her? How did it happen? Done.
Yeah. It's over. It's over, Helen, I said.
Helen. I'm trying to think, and I can't go there. Pete and Dud.
Yes, well, yeah.
So, yeah. Of course.
Tap, 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 she goes. Tap, tap, tap on the window.
Not that. Put your clothes back on and that for. I got a small house in Italy and she lives down the road from me and I got to know her. And she's very nice, very, very nice person and just agreed to do it. So that's it.
Beautiful. Suggs, thanks for coming on, man.
Thank you, mate. Thank you very much, guys. Yeah,
great talking to you.
Good
mate.
Fun, it was.
As ever.
Luck with the album. And you're going on tour, doing a Christmas tour, aren't you?
We're just about to get off. Yeah. It's all going well. All sold out and all that. It's all good.
Ah, he's a jovial bloke. You know, he's got some great stories, isn't he? I bet he's good round a Christmas table.
He's very good round a Christmas table. Ebullient, I would say, is the word.
How dare you?
No, it's just the way my trousers hang.
Is that what they taught you at Waterloo? Words like that. Anyway, thank you to our producer, Ben Jones, and for Gimme Sugar. And we enjoy this, don't we? We love it.
We love it. Well, especially when it's like that, then that really was. But that was just like a... It was like being at a great lunch, wasn't it?
It was. It was. Except,
certainly was for him.
Yeah. And you haven't paid the bill again. Yeah. The next one's on you.
I promise.
Good night from me.
And good night from them.
Rockanteurs is produced by Gimme Sugar Productions for Warner Music Group UK.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.